start this here. Okay. Good. The last time we already started with respect to the background, the historical development, and here just one additional aspect with enterprise computing. Here, the one point is that you have something like a highly integrated and highly reliable computing environment, usually what is requested. Let me check. Well, I have to check if the recording actually works correctly. Therefore, I need my green light here to see that. Therefore, in that sense, we would say it's something like highly integrated and usually in an environment or in an within a company, we would expect a highly reliable system. The point is here, the applications are somewhat immune against the structure or the distribution of data and services. So here, you could say the applications are immune against structure and distribution of data. That means it can be here somewhere on a database file systems, and the other aspect would be services. Therefore, in that sense, the services can be exist somewhere in the environment, and they can just be connected via the intranet. And therefore, in that sense, usually, if we talk about enterprise computing, this would be something like the intranet and not an internet connection. If it's a global active company, then usually either they build up a worldwide intranet or they use the internet and then use private links or virtual private links to have something like a secure communication between the different between the different entities of the company in the world. Usually, what you have is a heterogeneous environment. It's even in if you have like an IT department, which usually tries to have something like a more homogeneous environment because of maintenance purposes to reduce the amount of money necessary for maintenance. But in general, you can't really avoid it to have a heterogeneous environment because you usually have always a development. The other thing is what you have is here more like a close or direct coupling. And if we look at SOA, the service-oriented architecture, there the trend is happening towards something like a loose coupling. And you don't really have this close or tight coupling anymore. And then you would get, or the company would get a lot more flexibility in exchanging or in replacing services through like subsequent or new up-to-date services without changing very much with the applications. Therefore, not only in an internet environment, you go more towards loose coupling, also in an intranet, the tendency is to have a more loose coupling instead of a tight coupling as we had in the past. The other aspects I want to briefly mention, in information consistency here, especially in the context of multiple copies of the same data, And if you have updates of the data, then you have to be to make sure that all the copies basically are up to date. And especially if you have a partial breakdown, then certain services or certain data storages are available. Other data storages are unavailable at the moment, and then you still have to take care of the consistency, especially if the systems come, or that partial system which broke down comes up again. Security, privacy, okay, that's you can already think of, partially that you can say data are secure, that they are only accessible by certain departments, like the management department or the research, advanced research department, but not other departments are allowed to see them. Then response time should be adequate, and usually also you want to have something like a fault-tolerant behavior. Fault tolerance, I mean that if certain failures occur, that the system still can continue to work. An easy example would be the following, that here you assume you have a service A, and this service A is not only provided by one server, but it can be provided by multiple servers. Therefore, they do some sharing. If the server the one basically fails, then the server 2 can take over that load, and then the service A would still be provided to the whole network. And that's what I mean with fault tolerance, and that you can actually tolerate certain faults and continue to provide all the services. That only works to a certain degree. And for example, and we will also see what type of fault tolerance there are possible. For example, if you look at telephone switching systems from telephone companies, that usually they have the switching system not only once, they have it twice or three times in existence. Usually the service is only provided by the switching system one, and the other two are basically something like a hot standby. And they know the actual state of the system one, and if the system one fails, they can basically can have a hot takeover and continue the service without people noticing much of interruption. There might be have a short click in it or something that something sounds a little bit strange, but they can still continue to take or to telephone here. And the intention is that the systems are basically available 99.9% in the service. The last thing is the autonomy of individual components. Therefore, you don't really, if you unplug a system, it basically unplugs only one component and the rest is still available. And therefore, in that sense, it's they work autonomously, have their own state, and they share it with the other components. The next thing, key characteristics, a few words to that, with motivation, certainly. It's the increasing importance of distributed systems. On one hand, the cost of processes and storage costs basically dwindled or are dwindling continuously. On the other hand, what was a very important part with the high bandwidth networks. And that's what I mentioned yesterday with respect to the video servers. Now, it's not really a problem anymore to basically stream videos across the network. If you went back 10, 15 years ago, the idea existed, but it was a problem on the one hand that the servers could handle multiple requests simultaneously, and the other problem was basically the delivery across the network. But that's not really a problem anymore. Depends where you are. I mean, in certain areas, more in the countryside, you might have connectivity problems with respect to high bandwidth networks. The other things is response times of mainframes are somewhat unpredictable depending how many jobs are running. But what was more important are that you have a number of applications with complex information management and with complex graphical user interface. The tendency is to put the graphical user interfaces into the client environment and do basically on the back-end side the information management and also take care of information consistency. And the other thing is the cooperation and usage of shared resources, especially of companies which act worldwide. Therefore, you might have people and groups which are located at different places in the world, but they still want to continue to work with each other. There's an informal definition of a distributed system, one from Tannenbaum, which basically comes more from a hardware-oriented view. And it says, well, you have a number of independent machines, computers. They run a heterogeneous environments with different operating systems. And they are connected via the network. And towards the user, they behave like a single machine. If you use the file system, usually you have no idea, is there one file server behind it? Are there two file servers behind it? Are there three machines behind it? To you, it appears it's a single file system. It behaves like a single machine. And that's what I meant with a more hardware-oriented view. The other thing is, like from Leslie Lamport, where you say, well, you wanna work with a system, and then at some point the system stops to work because a machine crashed you never heard of your life. And in the early days of NFS, you had the situation, and you still have the possibility of something like hard links and soft links. And with hard links, basically the problem is the client tries to hard mount the remote part of the file system. And if the remote part of the file system is not available, it basically waits. It waits until this remote part is available. And therefore, then the system on your side hangs because it just waits until the remote side comes up. And with a soft connection, it's something like it tries it repeatedly. And after four or five tries, it basically comes back NFS not responding. And you on your side can continue to work on. And in the other case, it blocks and locks your machine, and you can't do anything anymore except basically kill that process. The definition we use, certainly we have a distribution of hardware, software. It's located at different machines. They communicate and basically coordinate their actions, basically passing messages. And the other alternative we will also look at is something like a shared memory, where we don't really use passing messages. We basically have shared information, and it's something similar in a way that we can say we have a blackboard, somebody writes something on it, another process comes and reads what's on it, and you have a completely decoupling of the two processes. And if you do communicate messages, you have a coupling of processes because you have a sender and a receiver. And there might be some, especially if you look at remote method invocation, you have a synchronous behavior. The one sends something, the receiver gets a request, reacts on it, and sends the result back. But sender and receiver are synchronized. With shared memory, like the white or blackboard, it's a complete decoupling of the involved processes. The other points of it, what I can mention here is the methods of distribution. What we can look at it, and certainly you can distribute hardware components like printers, like processors. The other thing is you can distribute the load. And load, I mean that processes or activities can be distributed across the network. And an example here is this Apache Mesos environment, which basically you would have something like, let's say, Mesos master. You would have something like Mesos slaves, and like N. And the other thing is you would have applications. And application 1, application N or M here. And then you would have something like a resource request sending, so here, resource request, sending basically what would the application need. It has a certain number of tasks or sub-processes or threads. I mean, resources, I don't mean here in a sense of I need a printer, I need a main memory. That's basically, these are tasks which have to be executed, and associated with these tasks are more or less then also the information how much memory these tasks need. The Mesos master knows what's here going on the slaves, and then it would basically also provide the applications here, something like resource offers. Therefore, in that sense, it doesn't mean that it actually satisfies completely the request. It would say, well, I have a certain a space available on a slave, but I have only 1 gigabyte available, and this one wanted to have basically 1.5 gigabyte. And then the application can decide if it takes that offer or doesn't take it. And then here you would have then something like assign task if the application takes the offer. Therefore, in that sense, now you distribute the load across a number of these slaves. And you would also have here on Apache also provides something like what is called zookeeper. And because here you already see the Mesos master is something like a single point of failure. And if the master is not available, then basically our load balancing does not work anymore, because you can't really send, accept requests, send offers, or assign tasks. Therefore, with the zookeeper, you have something like a fault tolerance environment that you can replicate the master. And if the master or the main master basically fails, the job would be taken over by the spare master to continue with services. The Mesos thing that's basically done by a company in California, it's was originally founded. There were several members in it who studied computer science here in Munich. We had some offers for some master thesis to go to California there. And if somebody is interested in doing that, and it's basically occurs in that context, then they would, I would provide the name to them, and then they have a certain selection mechanism if it's possible or not to do the thesis on it. And the software, basically, it's partially also used for the implementation in Twitter, and the other things where it's used is in Airbnb, the implementation. I don't know if you know the services or the large social networks. And it's public domain via the Apache constraints available to other institutions. There are other certain implementations. I know also another example of load balancing was something like at Xerox PARC, that you have the situation that, for example, if you went to lunch and your machine was in an idle state, therefore there was nothing going on, you basically just stopped, the machine was on, and there was also something like a master, like a worm, creeping in the network, checking for idle machines, and then processes were transported to these idle machines, and then when you came back and hit the carriage return button to basically log in, and then the process basically migrated back to the original environment again, together with its results, which it did the computation. The problem with load balancing is here, if the processes must match with respect to the execution and environment. Therefore, in that sense, if you migrate the process or tasks, then they have to match, they have to be executable. You can't have an application and say, well, I have here a process available for the macOS, and now I have a machine available on the Windows 7. It's you can't just take a macOS process and say, okay, now I have a Windows machine and put that process on there. That's not really possible. You have to do a lot more transformation to make that possible. The other thing is you can distribute the data, replicate data, partition data. There are a whole bunch of possibilities. Control. Therefore, in that sense, the control is not in a single environment. It's basically in multiple on multiple components. And therefore, in that sense, you have a distribution of control. If one control part fails, then possibly the other control parts can take that over. Or you can do a distributed execution. Therefore, in that sense, this here also falls load as well as processing in that sense. It basically is relevant for both of it. What we will look in the course, we will basically look on these later parts and not so much on load balancing and things like that, and more on these data control and processing distribution. The next things from the properties that I mentioned already, a number of it, that we say, well, functional units, I have multiple of them, and they are distributed. Functional units can be physical, like hardware, or logical, like software. And we distribute them. They can break down independently. That means also if we have a distribution of services, like your whole application consists of, let's say, 5 or 10 services and a number of client applications, all these services, all these clients might fail independently. And the distribution component control, if you have a distributed operating system control, certainly you you can think of what would be as part of it in it on a local operating system. Certainly you need something like here the local memory management. There are certain letters missing. Then what you certainly have is also process creation and scheduling. You would also have something like certainly process communication. And if you distribute all your services, an important part is basically the inter-process communication that can be local, but also across the intranet or the internet. And then you would also have something like the management of local periphery, the local peripherals. And that's something like especially what you need for a local part of a distributed operating system control. Every local part would have that. The other important properties, transparency. And there you can look at it. We would say transparency in a sense of IT or computer science perspective. Therefore, in that sense, you hide things and to reduce complexity. If you think of transparency in society, for example, the institution of Transparency International, what does it mean? It means just the opposite. It's not hiding things. It make everything visible and make everything accessible to the people who look at it. Therefore, in that sense, it's sometimes difficult if you talk with a person like political science and social sciences, and then comes the computer scientists who talk about transparent, and that's what make transparent and things like that, thinking of his services. And therefore, in that sense, he thinks of hiding things. And the other one, basically the social scientist, says, oh yeah, make everything obvious and make everything visible. Therefore, in that sense, that's a typical example of a term which has different meanings with different groups of people. And the last thing is cooperative autonomy. Here, cooperative means you have services competing over shared resources. They might compete with it, but they are not malicious, and they are not really try to basically give wrong information to other components. And therefore, for concurrency, you might have semaphores, which you use now in a distributed environments. You might have transactions to get an atomic behavior of operations. In that sense, to basically handle concurrency with process execution across multiple machines. The other things, challenges, a few things to handle. An important aspect in a distributed environment is the heterogeneous environment. And heterogeneous certainly applies to networks. What type of networks do you have? Certainly the the protocols in somewhat reduced the number of different networks that you usually basically everything is done on TCP IP networks. If you went back in the past, you had Apple Talk, you had token rings, you had all different types of networks. You still have different types of networks. In a sense, do you have a wireless LAN? Do you have cable-based connectivity? Do you have an optical cable? Do you have an electrical connectivity? You might have differences with respect to the frames which are sent. The one allows larger frames, the other one allows only shorter frames. Therefore, if a larger frame comes, it has to be divided. Then you need something like sequence numbers. Then on the receiving end, you can basically put it together to a large frame again in the correct order. Therefore, in that sense, you have heterogeneous situation. Also, hardware, in a sense, well, do you use PCs? Do you use workstations? Do you use mainframes? operating systems here, Windows, Mac OS, Linux, etc. And the other thing is certainly with respect to programming languages, do you do program in C#? Do you do it in Java? Do you do it in C++? And the point is that you might have a C++ client basically interacting with a C# service, and they exchange requests and response messages, and for the Java client or C++ client, it doesn't matter if the one is C# or not. What you usually try to do, and that's what happens, is because if you do that, handle the heterogeneous situation on the application level, it's very error-prone. And you might do in a programming with considering all kinds of different possibilities. You might have a good chance to include a whole bunch of bugs. And what very early on was done to look at something like middleware, to provide something like a programming abstraction to the application programmer, and the application programmer basically uses then only the programming abstraction. On the programming abstraction, you could think of, well, do you use, remote method in vocation. That would be something like an example of it. Do you use client-server interaction? Do you use remote event notification? That's, for example, what Google very intensively uses, this remote event notification, in a sense of that you have publish and subscribe. Therefore, they have this for processes they can subscribe that they're interested in certain event modifications. If modifying events take place on certain things, if they take place, they get a notification. And that's a type of programming abstraction what you can use on the application level. And there are a number of them. And therefore, in that sense, you get something like a uniform computational model on the application level. What kind of middleware do you have? CORBA and Java RMI are example, but also Google has its own middleware which it uses internally, and a few things we will talk about. It's very much of this map and reduce approach what they use. The other important challenges are openness. And openness means, on the one hand, you have something like standardized interfaces. And we have also something like integration of existing and future services. And that's the problem with future services. With existing, you can basically look at what's the functionality of the services, what kind of interface or what kind of parameters they need, and then you can decide with respect to your interface what you support. But the problem is, well, with future. And the intention is that you have something like an open environment where you are, that you can accept also future services to use with. And for example, if you think of the whole Web 2.0 or the whole social computing, if you think of it, the situation in the internet environment in the 90s. Nobody really thought of applications like Facebook and things like that. And therefore, in a sense, there it was more like have only a few people or few institutions which provide and actively generate content. You have many people accessing it and reading it. Therefore, you have few writers and many readers. And now with the new environment, you have also many writers and not just many readers. Scalability, adding new resources while the system is still up and running. That means you don't really want to have something like turn it down and then restart it again. Then here's security, and security certainly you would have something like confidentiality. Therefore, in that sense, you would something like to encrypt things. You would have another aspect would be something like integrity. If you think of messages, that the message was not modified by somebody and the sender looks original and the message looks original, but it's not really the same message which was sent by the original sender. It was somewhat modified. And the other thing is, if you think of services, its availability, and that services are available, and there, you know, this denial of service attacks which sent millions of requests to a service and then can't handle it and then basically doesn't accept any real service requests anymore because it's over flooded by spam requests. And certainly privacy here. If you look at profile information, there it can be provided explicitly by the user to basically have something like a personalized service behavior and a personalized functionality and personalized user interface. But the other thing is it can be also implicitly by tracking your behavior, and that's what, for example, what Amazon does. It tracks your purchasing history. It tracks your history with respect to looking at products, and then it uses that to makes hints what might be interesting for you. And certainly that's a part of it which should be protected, because it's, on one hand, the user wants to have that, to have more personalized service. On the other hand, it's also might be used by some attackers to use that information. And like, for example, certainly if you think of that you try to visit certain websites with respect to certain sicknesses, and your insurance finds out that, then you might have something like a reduced service, or they don't accept any change of your health insurance because they say, oh yeah, that person might be have this kind of sickness and so on. Therefore, in that sense, it's really very sensitive information. Examples of development frameworks, and originally these applications were usually built on a bare transport layer, but that has a high risk of bugs and high risk of failures. For example, if you program all your process interaction on a TCP level, that you program all the messages, you have to look at the TCP header. You have to basically program the correct TCP header also with checksum and things like that. That makes it very difficult in programming. If you use Java environment, or also you basically have library functions which makes you a stream of data which is then mapped into appropriate TCP messages on a lower level. And therefore, as an application programmer, you're not involved in that. Here I have listed a few of them that had an impact on with respect to application programming. One of it is Sun NFS. Here previously Sun, and now it's Oracle, which bought Sun. There, the important contribution with NFS was the network file system, which behaved like a centralized file system. To the process, it always had the feeling with a centralized file system, and read and write operations were the same, independent if it was a local read-write or if it was a remote read-and-write. It was basically on the NFS level, it was mapped to the message exchange or to a local read and write. The next aspect was then the ONC, also Sun, to have a platform for distributed application design, and it included libraries for remote procedure call. There the extension was, usually you know procedure calls from Pascal and C, but they were only in an environment where all the procedures were available in a local process. And there you could make now a procedure call as you learn it in a programming course. And the important aspect was that on the application level, procedure call was procedure call. And then it was, with the libraries, it was mapped either into a local call or it was mapped into a remote procedure call. And remote procedure call meant mapping the procedure call into a message, a request message, sending it across the network, and then taking the request message and generate out of it a procedure call again. And then the remote procedure was called, and it never had any idea, is it a local call or remote call? It just behaved like a regular call. And that was the contribution of ONC, together with the external data representation that we will also look at later, because some computers and also program environments have different representations. Look at C and the representation of strings. If you took a string, you basically, the string stops when you have a null character, when you have a null. If you use other program environments, you have two parts. First comes the length, and then comes the string with respect to the length. And that's a completely different representation of it. And therefore, in that sense, you need some kind of mapping between data representation. That's also part of it. ODP, that was an approach with ISO, and it was not really successful. And for example, for the people who went to the computer networking course, and I don't know how many of you who attended the computer networking course. I mean, the one part of it, you learn about these protocols. And for example, you have these protocol suites, and one of is what we usually use, the TCP/IP protocol suite. And there was an at some point an alternative protocol suite with the ESO OC reference model, and basically with the seven layers. And it decided the interface that the components across the network were able to exchange messages going back and forth. But with the ESO OC reference model, it did not say anything about the behavior of the components. The only thing what it prescribed was the data exchanging between the components and possibly the sequence of messages to exchange it. But what the remote component does with it, like let's say the semantic description of the behavior, that is not part of the ESO OSI reference model. And that at that point was the intention of the open distributed processing. They tried to basically build on this ESO OSI reference model and say, well, now we not just model the interfaces, but we also and describe the component behavior. And And therefore, in that sense, when we try to make a match between a component, then the sending component could go to like a registry and say, well, I need a service which has this type of behavior. And then the registry would answer it and would provide the IP address, the interface, and so on, of a component which basically fulfills that semantic behavior. That was the original intention. It turned out to be so complex. They had something like a reference implementation on the basis of CORBA, but it was not really any successful. And if you look now at web services with a web service description language, there you have now a step towards that description, towards that idea. In the web service description languages, you try to describe a service and not just the interface as you have from the ISO/OSI reference model with respect to the TCP messages and application messages like HTTP or the SMTP, but you also say what is the data structure of these messages, what kind of data types they have, what kind of services they provide to it. And therefore you could make something like a web service matching with respect to towards a client who is interested in a certain service. And therefore this was started in the 90s. And with web services, basically 10, 15 years later, it's another try, not as extensive as this here, but in a way towards that idea. Then common CORBA, or common object request broker, an important part was that you allowed the interaction between different distributed objects, like C++ object was then able to invoke an Objective-C object. And it still has a place, but a lot of the activities are basically then done either pure in C# or in Java, and Java also allows or C# allows invocation of Java objects and the reverse, and other good Apple always still uses Objective-C, but there were also a number of other object-oriented languages which don't really have such significance anymore as these three, as I mentioned. And important part was here, RMI. The last thing was here with .NET and middleware in the Microsoft environment, and here certainly with C# as a competitor to Java. And in one hand, it's very similarly structured as the Java framework. Here you have libraries in the sense of and the runtime environment. Here you have these class libraries and also runtime environment. And then additionally you have the distributed component object model, DCOM, which was originally intended that applications could invoke each other in an integrated way. Like, for example, if you look at Microsoft Word, and that could integrate like a spreadsheet. And then the implementation of the spreadsheet functionality was not within Word. It was basically an Excel component integrated in a Word document. And therefore, if you clicked on the spreadsheet, then it invoked the Excel function to edit things, and the same thing with graphics. And that was the original thing with the component object model, and then they extended it towards a distributed component object model that the components or the objects could be distributed across the network. And on the other hand, they had .NET, and at some point it just merged to it and integrated it. Here a quick definition of distributed application. We assume now here a set of cooperating interacting functional units, and cooperating in a means that they are not malicious against each other. They basically are, let's say, positively competing about with respect to their shared resources. We have a certain parallelism. We have fault tolerance. That means services could take over the functionality of other components, and it's coming out of an inherent distribution. And for example, you would have something like e-commerce applications which are somewhat across the network implemented. You would have groupware applications, like cooperating people working together. And in that sense, there are a whole bunch of distributed applications, as I already mentioned it. Or like global supply chain management. And in that sense, certainly you have components of your application which exist in different environments. The definition, what we use in the following, that we assume that the functionality of an application is split into a set of cooperating and interacting components. And each component has an internal state and operations which manipulate the state. Additionally, we assume they are autonomous entities, and they are usually assigned different machines, but it could be that multiple components are on the same, located on the same machine, but they use inter-process communication. They don't use shared memory. They use inter-process communication. And that allows us to migrate one component to another machine without changing anything, because if they use inter-process communication, basically the interaction still can continue. If it's a local IPC or if it's a global IPC across the network. And the last thing is here that the interaction takes place via the network. And can we have? Certainly, we can have message exchange. We can have remote method invocation. We can possibly use like object migration. It's also a possibility that objects migrate from one environment to another and to another environment. And in that sense, there are different types of programming paradigms which might be used in the application. The last thing is from the programmer's perspective that we have something like interaction points between the different components, and these interaction points occur via the interfaces. And if we look at it, at the two situations, we have an export interface and we have an import interface. And here we can say mostly generated automatically. As here, generated automatically. And in the early days, they were basically handcrafted. And now it's something like also if you do Java programming and using RMI, you can make your specification of your object. You can specify the object as a remote or a possibly remote invocable. And then it's possibly to generate with the either with R, the RMI gen, or it's already included in the new RMI library functions. It generates the appropriate interface. And these interfaces, like what we can say here, this component deposits the interface somewhere in an interface library or in a directory service. That's, for example, what web services do. They publish their interface in like a universal directory service, and then you have other components.